Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing the National Disability Insurance Scheme, known commonly as the NDIS. It was launched in 2013, and 10 years on, the federal government is undertaking an independent review into the scheme. Professor Jennifer Smith-Mary is watching the review closely. She is the Professor of Health and Social Policy and the Director of the Centre for Disability Research and Policy at the University of Sydney. Professor Smith-Mary has written about the NDIS in the Medical Journal of Australia, and the link to her article is in the description of this podcast. Professor Smith-Mary is with me now. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be here and chatting about my favourite topic, the NDIS.
Professor Smith-Mary, we're 10 years on from the establishment of the NDIS. Where is the scheme at now, and what surprises you about the NDIS's current state?
I think what surprises me most about the NDIS at the moment is that we've been in a constant state of introducing the NDIS for 10 years. So it's not like we introduced the NDIS in 2013 and it's been settling ever since. We've actually been reintroducing the NDIS continuously. So we've been discovering the NDIS as we've gone along.
You mention in a piece that you've written for the Medical Journal of Australia that certain groups of the population are failing to receive the services they need. What is the current issue with equity in the scheme?
So I think it goes back to this idea of discovering the NDIS. So we decided back in 2011 that we needed a program such as the NDIS to ensure that people with disability are able to live included lives in Australia. And that's fantastic. It's a fantastic idea, and it's one that we should be really proud of supporting nationally. When we came to actually implement it, I think it's actually been much trickier to ensure that people with disability have the opportunity to have included lives no matter what their disability, no matter where they live, no matter how they come into the scheme. That has been the tricky thing. So I think that what's happened is that implementing it in the same way for everyone has just pointed out existing inequities that impact on our health system more generally and our social care system more generally. And that's meant that people in rural and regional areas, they get less access to the NDIS. That particular groups with more complex needs, they are less able to have their needs met. And that some groups of people with particular types of disability have their needs less met. Now, that would happen generally in the health system unless we put in place different strategies to meet the needs of those groups. So I think really it's this issue of the NDIS still finding its feet and then being able to put in place those strategies to address equity. That's the issue.
And when the NDIS was established, we saw state-based disability programs decline or become less active, and the NDIS was then called the only lifeboat in the ocean. Can you tell me how that came to be and how effective or ineffective that is in delivering disability programs?
So when the NDIS came about, it was funded in a couple of ways. One was through raising the Medicare levy. The other one was through funding from state and federal governments that was going to come from winding up particular programs supporting people with disability, because there was an assumption that the people that received support from those programs would then receive support from the NDIS. That hasn't been the case, and I can talk more about that. I sigh when I think about it, but it was a very simplistic understanding of what the NDIS would do. So there was an idea that the NDIS would basically do everything when it came to disability. And so you saw a removal of disability supports from the education system, some parts of the education system, from lots and lots of different parts of the social care system. In New South Wales, for example, we lost the whole Department of Ageing, Disability and Home Care that was wound up. And you lost federal government programs such as Partners in Recovery and the Personal Helpers and Mentors program. Those programs, particularly for people with severe and complex mental health problems, those programs were wound up with the assumption that all those participants would go into the NDIS, when that was not the case. So our research has found that actually only around 50% of those people were going into the NDIS. So that led to a huge shortfall, which has deepened inequity, not just within the scheme, but outside of the scheme as well.
So there's at least two inequity issues going on here inside the scheme and the people outside the scheme. How are the people with disability outside the scheme getting supported?
So there are some legacy programs. There are some programs in place, and there are programs in place through the education department, for example, that disability supports are still there, for example, in primary schools and high schools. They're getting some supports, but a lot of the supports that they were getting have been wound up and have been defunded. That causes significant problems within the scheme as well, because it means that people are desperate to hang on to their NDIS plans, and it means that people are desperate to get into the scheme, and that puts pressure on the scheme and the scheme as a whole, and it creates this whole discourse around the affordability of the NDIS. So a lot of that is caused by the fact that it's the lifeboat in the ocean, that everyone is desperate to get on because there's no other supports that are available for them.
And I'd like to dig a bit deeper to understand the desperation of people trying to get their child onto the NDIS. We've, of course, seen headlines about parents paying a fortune to get their children into the right specialists and to get the right documentation. Why is the NDIS just so difficult to get into?
It is a scheme that takes a lot of evidence to get into. So it has very strong criteria around entry into the NDIS. So, for example, one of the issues that we talk about in relation to people with mental illness or psychosocial disability getting into the NDIS is that the permanence criteria for the NDIS is lifelong permanent disability, which is difficult for people with psychosocial disability to prove, because when people have mental health problems, it's often fluctuating in nature. You can't say that it's going to be lifelong. And in fact, we know that a lot of mental health problems are not lifelong. But when you have them, they can be disabling to the extent where you need the support that the NDIS provides. So the NDIS permanence criteria mean that you have to prove permanence to get into the scheme. And to do that, you have to sort of show that you've had a condition for a long period. So you have to have the evidence there. You have to go and see the right people. You have to get specialists together. Some of those specialists have really long waiting lists. So, for example, in some rural areas, you've got a years-long waiting list to see specialists. And that means that it's difficult to get into the scheme. One of the groups that we work with is people who are homeless. So homeless people, for example, with psychosocial disability, in real, actually desperate need for the scheme, don't understand the scheme, don't understand how to enter it, need support to do that. But one of the big problems is a lack of consistency around services that they've been able to access. So if you're not able to say, oh, I've been to see this GP for this long or specialist for this long, it's very difficult to get together the evidence that's going to meet that permanence criteria and entry criteria for the NDIS.
My special guest today is Professor Jennifer Smith-Merry, who is the Professor of Health and Social Policy and the Director of the Centre for Disability Research and Policy at the University of Sydney. Professor Smith-Merry, who is the typical person on the NDIS?
So I think this has been a topic of the media, in the media recently, that Around 50% of the NDIS are people under 18, and a significant proportion of that population are young men with an autism diagnosis. That's concerning, not because people with autism shouldn't be on the NDIS. They absolutely should be part of the NDIS. What's concerning is that it doesn't show a very balanced population group in the scheme. So, for example, you might see less people of a particular group. So we often point to psychosocial disability, people with mental illness, not getting into the scheme on par with other groups, and then once they're in the scheme, not using their plans as well as other groups. So I think I want to emphasise that people with autism absolutely should be on the scheme. What that figure points out is that the scheme is not working in an equitable way, or it's not functioning in the way that it should in order to get the full range of people with disability who need it into the scheme.
And Jennifer, you've written in your article for the Medical Journal of Australia that there are some populations that are traditionally underserved in health and social care that are accessing the NDIS. What are those populations?
So some of the figures show that people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds are accessing and utilising the scheme at a higher level than other groups. Now, that's a group that's traditionally underserviced in terms of health and social care. I believe what that points to is actually, it actually has nothing to do with cultural and linguistic diversity. What it has to do with is that that is a group that is in metropolitan areas primarily, and that this is a scheme that functions well in metropolitan areas where particular groups can be targeted by service providers and those services are able to operate. And why I think that's the case is because if you look across the board, people who live in rural and remote areas are not accessing the scheme at the levels that they at the levels that are on par with people in metropolitan areas.
Let's turn now to what changes you would like to see. You've talked about more equity. You've just mentioned there that one of the possible, you know, gaps that could be filled is more people who are eligible from regional rural areas getting onto the scheme. What are some of those equity gaps that you would like to see addressed either by the review or by the NDIA?
I think that there needs to be more engineering of the scheme. There's an idea that sits behind the scheme, which is that service providers will appear to meet people's needs. So the NDIS provides budgets for people with disability who are on the NDIS, and then those budgets can be used to purchase services from a disability support or disability care market. So we assume that that disability care market will be there to provide those supports, but it doesn't operate in areas where there's poor economies of scale. So in rural and remote areas where you don't have a lot of people, you might not be able to access the service that you need because there's no services that can provide that at a cost that is suitable. Similarly, if you have high support and very specialised support needs, even if you're in a metropolitan area, it can be tricky to get the services that you need. And again, it's because the specialised supports, there are less services available to provide them as well. And that causes inequity for people with more specific or highly specialised needs. So originally the NDIS was going to be a provider of last resort in those cases, but we haven't seen that it's functioned in that type of way as yet.
And so what are the risks? What are the risks of not addressing these inequities? And does that mean people with really complex disabilities may have to move to areas where there are more services?
I think we often have this assumption that people living in rural and remote areas, that they're making a choice and therefore that they should expect less quality care or lower quality care or have poorer health outcomes, when I think that's a really poor assumption for us to be making. But I think we do it all the time, and I think we do it in the NDIS. We cannot and absolutely should not expect people with disability to move to metropolitan areas to get the support that they need. I mean, where would they live for a start? The housing situation is very problematic for people with disability support needs in metropolitan areas as well. We should not be expecting people to do that. So what we need to do is design the scheme so that it's better able to meet the needs of people in those areas. One of the ways that we can do that is through better market design. So engineering markets where there aren't any. So incentives for providers to provide support. We absolutely need to have a better understanding of markets and not just leave it up to the market to decide where to provide support for people with disability.
Okay, so how do we make sure we have a scheme that looks after people with very complex disabilities and making sure they face minimal barriers in living a fulfilling life?
Currently, this is a significant problem facing the NDIS and its operation. And it's something that's evidenced in the way Bill Shorten's been pointing out how people get stuck in hospital, for example. So people get stuck in hospital for months and months, people with complex disability support needs, and that's because they don't have anywhere to go. Now, that's part of an NDIS problem, but it's also a problem of there not being this architecture around the NDIS to support people with complex needs. And that means that organisations can't come together in order to get people out of the problems that they're in. So if you're stuck in hospital, or if you're stuck in jail, for example, or if you're stuck in some other situation that you shouldn't be in, you need a range of different providers to come together. Currently, the NDIS cannot force other providers to come together to support that person or to get them out of hospital. And currently, the budgets of people with disability cannot be used in that type of way in order to coordinate a lot of services. There's support coordination, but that's quite limited in what it can do. So the NDIS needs to function in a way where for people with severe and complex needs, the system is able to come together around them. We don't have any sort of oversight of the system that allows that, and that's very problematic for those people. And it is a significant issue in equity, because it means that people can't even use the scheme. If you're stuck in hospital, you can't even use the scheme. So it means that people with complex needs are not having the outcomes they should in relation to the NDIS.
Professor Jennifer Smith-Merry, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. And I'd love to come back and talk about the NDIS anytime. Thank you.
Professor Jennifer Smith-Merry is the Professor of Health and Social Policy and the Director of the Centre for Disability Research and Policy at the University of Sydney. She has written about the NDIS in the Medical Journal of Australia, and the link to her article is in the description of this podcast. You can find more podcasts from the Medical Journal of Australia on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.